My name is Laura Chiello. I'm the Director of Programs and Communications at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And first of all, I'd like to acknowledge the students of the Lions Dance Troupe here at the Folk Arts Cultural Treasures Charter School and their instructor, Helen Jim, for that wonderful performance. This event tonight was organized by the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. We're a library and archive that's located not too far from here at 1300 Locust Street. The Balch Institute for Ethnic Studies merged with the Historical Society 10 years ago, and we hold their collections, including records and photographs documenting the history of the Chinese American community. We welcome you all to visit our library, and you can also visit us online at hsp.org. The Historical Society recently published an edition of its magazine on the topic of Philadelphia's Chinatown, and copies are available at the registration desk for sale. I'd like to thank a few people who made this event possible. First, we'd like to thank the Connolly Foundation, who supported the event. And a big thank you to the Folk Arts Cultural Treasures Charter School, who graciously allowed us to have our event here, especially the help of Principal Susan Stengel and Deputy Director Janaya Hizzle. Also, the Philadelphia Chinatown Development Corporation, in particular, Executive Director John W. Chin, who's one of our panelists this evening, and Deputy Director Rachel Mack. Finally, I'd like to thank you all for coming this evening. And introduce our moderator, Catherine Wilson. Dr. Wilson is an associate professor of history at Georgia State University. She's currently at work on a book about Chinatown with a working title, Ethnic Renewal, Space, Place, and Struggle in Philadelphia's Chinatown. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Wilson.
Thank you, Lori. Well, tonight we're here to talk about Chinatown. We're in Chinatown. I don't know how much you all know about the history. We're going to explore the history tonight. Chinatown had its origins really in violence and backlash against Chinese in the western United States in the 1870s. Sent many Chinese laborers east to work in eastern cities like New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and Baltimore. So in many ways, Chinatown has always been a sanctuary, a place of safety and self-affirmation for Chinese Americans, even as it was in many ways formed in a context of segregation and racism. People settled in Chinatown because there was nowhere else they could live. Initially, this largely male society grew into a family community, and by the post-war period was a thriving neighborhood. At the same time, was increasingly under threat from urban renewal in the late 1960s, most particularly from the construction of the Vine Street Expressway, which you may have crossed in order to get to this building this evening. The resistance to this expressway and the efforts to save Holy Redeemer Chinese Catholic Church, which was threatened by those plans, catalyzed the community movement, which resulted in, among other things, the creation of PCDC, whose director is here this evening, to preserve the neighborhood. The subsequent decades saw a period of growth, development, and change in Chinatown as new immigration also contributed to the texture of the neighborhood. But the neighborhood still struggled. After all of this change and building of housing and growing the community, as late as 2000, there was a major threat to the community in the form of another urban redevelopment project at Philadelphia Phillies Stadium, which was also resisted successfully by the community. So Chinatown is no longer the only place that Chinese or Asian immigrants can live and work. It is not the only place where they are in the Philadelphia region, but it continues to be meaningful and important for Chinese Americans and Asians all over the greater Delaware Valley. And tonight we want to explore some of the reasons why that is the case, to look into the history of Chinatown, people's experience of Chinatown, the legacy of activism in the community, and then also what is going on in Chinatown today? What are some of the challenges? What does Chinatown mean for us all? So I'd like to introduce our panelists who are going to discuss this evening. We have John Chin, who actually grew up in Chinatown and has many memories of the neighborhood. And he is the executive director of the Philadelphia Chinatown Development Corporation, which was founded out of the Save Chinatown movement in the late 1960s. We have Roseanne Liu, who is a PhD candidate in anthropology and education at the University of Pennsylvania. And she's also working in her research on Philadelphia's Chinatown. And we have Deborah Way, who is the daughter of undocumented immigrants and a beneficiary of affirmative action, a founder of Asian Americans United, and also the founding principal of the FACTS School. She currently works as the director of the Office of Multilingual Curriculum and Programs in the School District of Philadelphia. So welcome to our panelists. Let's start with a little bit about the history of Chinatown. And I'm curious about your experiences. Many of you have memories that are really reflect that history. So let's talk a little bit about some of your first experiences of Chinatown and what Chinatown was like in your living memory.
So as a young boy growing up in Chinatown, I really didn't know any different. Growing up in this neighborhood, Captain used the word sanctuary. It felt like a community, it felt like a sanctuary, it felt like my home. And I didn't know that other neighborhoods were very, very different from Chinatown. I didn't experience a lot of the bias or racism or bigotry that was many others might have experienced outside Chinatown. And it wasn't until I was older that I realized that there was a whole world that was outside Chinatown that wasn't so friendly, wasn't so community-oriented, and wasn't so family-oriented. Even with the fact that, in Chinatown, I lived in three different places in Chinatown, yet I was still within three blocks, no more than three blocks from one home to another. At the center of Chinatown, 10th and Ray Streets, I do remember as a young boy, out of the four corners, three of them had bars, okay? At that time, to the bars, there was a front entrance and there was an entrance with a sign that said ladies entrance, okay? So back in the 70s, there were a lot of different things going on. There were many different biases, right? Including bias against women. And to the bars had something called go-go bars, right? And they had shades drawn, but they had ladies dancing on top of the bars. You walk down towards where the Friendship Gate is right now, you had on the one corner something called a modeling agency. As a boy, I didn't realize that modeling agency meant that men could go in there and pretend to take pictures of naked women. You go down half a block in the other corner, you had the Trocadero, which was a wonderful opera place when it first opened up. But as a young boy, the Trocadero, if many of you know, was a place that offered burlesque shows. So this is the Chinatown I grew up in, and I didn't know any better. But yet, I still felt safe in this community. It was a small community at that time, and everybody knew one another. And there were some very strong institutions that sort of kept the youth and the children in check and watched over them. They were the churches, the Christian Church, the Holy Redeemer Catholic Church, and many of the associations. So that was the community that I grew up in.
And I probably had like almost the negative picture, like the opposite of what John did. I grew up in Upper Darby, which is like probably one of the most racist towns my parents could have possibly picked for me to grow up in. It was at that time, I will out myself, I'm 55. We moved to Upper Darby when I was three, and it was a white working class enclave. I think there was one other Asian family in Upper Darby, and then that was it. And I learned to run real fast. My brother said, if someone's bothering you, kick them right there and run. it was rough growing up, but it also was real, very, kind of gritty and real. But I do know that once a week, every week, religiously, we piled in the car and drove down to Chinatown, because Chinatown had the things that we needed to survive, to live, and most importantly, the food. So my mother, I remember my mother would, every 5 or 10 years, she needed a new cleaver. you know, Chinese, like, they use these big knives. Like, they're scary looking. And she would try to find them in stores outside. She didn't speak English well. And she'd draw pictures, and they would want to call the cops. Like, I thought she was chopping up bodies in the basement. So, you know, we had to come down to Chinatown to get anything as basic as, at those times, you couldn't pick soy sauce up in the local A&P. You had to get it in Chinatown. Ginger, cloves of garlic, rice that wasn't weird, you know, like just stuff. And I remember every week we'd come down without fail. We went to Wing On down on 9th Street, and they had a little cat that I used to play with. And I remember signing the petitions against the Vine Street Expressway. So Chinatown always actually was this strange place to me, because it was this place where everyone looked like me, but I wasn't of the place, because I was in Upper Darby and I'm with all these Greeks and Italians and Irish people. It wasn't until I was in college that I actually came to Chinatown and felt like, oh, I'm in Chinatown now. I took a year off, or not, a semester, an urban semester. And I was working as a housing organizer, actually up in North Philly, but I came down to Chinatown and was volunteering at Holy Redeemer to teach Chinese dance. And then Mitzi McKenzie hired me for the summer to run the arts. And I don't even know if you remember me from that summer, because I remember you, but I definitely remember.
Is that good or bad?
I actually remember your sister more, because she kept wanting me to draw the logo from Greece for her. And I was like, why do you want this logo? But I was running the arts and crafts program for the summer in the Chinese Christian Church. And I was the time when I just started finally feeling like, after my whole life of feeling like I never had a place, that I started feeling like this could be my place. I have never lived in Chinatown. My husband actually stood in line to get one of the units that opened up on Ray Street. I can't even remember the name of that housing unit, where the one that is. But anyways, well, he stood in line and got the last, actually no, Anna Jung got the last apartment, but then she didn't want it or need it. She turned around, she saw Ming, and she said, here, you take it. And Ming got the last apartment. And then he turned around, this is so typical Chinatown, he turned around and he saw a friend of ours' father who was retired, couldn't speak English, low income, and we really wanted to live down here. And he turned around and he had stood in line a long time to get this. So Anna handed him her ticket and he turned around and handed it to Jumwa's dad. So we never lost that chance, but when my mother-in-law came to live with us for a short time, one of the things, we were looking for a house to live in. We actually, literally, we put a compass point on at 10th and Race. We drew a circle around what would be walking distance for my mother-in-law, and we looked for housing in that area. And so I live at 10th and Baybridge, because it was a straight shot down to Chinatown.
I'm interested in having your thoughts on, we know that for a long time Chinatown was known as a bachelor society, that a lot of the people who originally settled this neighborhood didn't even plan necessarily to stay in the United States, and that there were very few families, merchant families early on. I'm wondering, how did this bachelor, the beginnings as a bachelor society, shape the neighborhood of Chinatown?
The bachelor societies were extremely important in shaping the Chinatowns. It's interesting that our Chinatown and the societies and the associations that are created are all they're regional. So depending on where your family originated from in China, that would be the family association that you would belong to. So that was one type of association. And new arrivals would be able to go to these associations and seek help. So you have groups of, you have individuals that form groups to help their own. So many villages, when one person settled in Philadelphia, they would be able to rely on one another to support them. So the Bachelor Society sort of created this hierarchy that's in Chinatown. Very, very, very male dominated. You know, I think it wasn't until maybe the 80s that women in Chinatown were able to sort of participate in this hierarchy of community politics. Yet I think they were smart about it. They said, well, if you don't want us, we don't need you. We're going to form our own women's groups. And you know, that's what they did. But I remember my father belonged to one family association for the Chin. So my surname is Chin. That's the association we belong to. Yet we were also part of a second organization called Toi San Nin Yeo, which is an association based on the village that my family was from. And then you had the third type of organization, which is more like a merchants or commerce organization. So you had these individual organizations, and they sort of formed like a pyramid. And at the top of that pyramid was what ended up being the Chinese Benevolent Association. And that's the associations you see around the United States. I think Chinatown's realized that it was difficult to manage individual organizations, difficult to come to decisions. So they ended up forming these consolidated Chinese Benevolent Associations.
I also, like, the thing about these bachelor societies was that they were created by laws of the United States. The laws that prohibited Chinese from coming to the United States made it very difficult to go back and visit and come back, prohibited women from joining their husbands. And so it was a very sad period for this community because the old guys were here separated from their homes and communities, kind of not by choice. I mean, they came here to work, they came here to send money home. But I remember my husband was volunteering to translate for Community Legal Services, and he was sent down here to work with an old guy named Bill. This was probably in the early 80s, and Bill must have been one of the last of the old timer bachelor guys. And he was living in the CDA building. It was pretty rough conditions. And Bill had developed kidney disease, and my husband was taking him regularly to the hospital and translating. And he came home one day and he said, you know, Bill sat me down and he pulled out a picture. And it was of this old man. And he said, this is my son. He's 62 now. And I haven't seen him since he was 2 years old. And then he said, you know, I think I finally saved enough money up. I'm going to go home at the end of the year and I'll be able to see my son. Well, Bill died because of his kidney disease, was never able to get home. And I remember Ming's sadness. And even now it's hard for me to tell the story because that it was not an easy life for a bachelor society. It was not an easy life for these guys. As I look at immigration reform and immigration laws and the things that have been done historically to keep families separated, they're real people, and you know, those are the stories I think of. So you know, it shaped the social conditions in Chinatown, but it also shaped individual lives in ways that we don't find in the history books because we don't get to write that history. Except you do. Yay!
Could I add something to it? Like Huoxan Village Association, Toisan. These are all the farming villages outside of Canton where all the rice farming. These people were laborers. They didn't own the land. They migrated to America. And the only, and some of the associations back when they were gambling, that's the only recreation they had. They had no recreation. And some of the people play mahjong. And my father, that's all he ever played. And so that's his only recreation. He didn't do nothing else. They don't go and play basketball like that. The one thing is, he left out something, John, that to save the Holy Redeemer Church and school. The school was very important to this community. It's the only Catholic school that has a waiting list. Mm-hmm. And that was very important. We fought hard. And it also preserved Roman Catholic High School, the first Catholic high school in the city. If Holy Redeemer went, Roman Catholic was in the past.
It's interesting, if you talked about the recreation and the loneliness of these early bachelors. If you had walked down the 900 block of Race Street at the turn of the century in the early 20th century, on the second floor above every store, there was a common room that was rented by one association or another, and that's where the men would gather. They'd play fontan or mahjong and eat and socialize, and that's where the early restaurants were, all on the second floors of these buildings, because they grew out of these common rooms where men would come every Sunday. All the laundrymen from all over the area would come down into Chinatown and hang out at their association common room.
Yeah. That was like their family. I mean, if you want to, you talk about like getting together with your family, that was the family. There was no other family.
And many of these men were living in extended kin relationships too. They had brought sons or they had cousins or uncles, or fictive or otherwise, that were living in the same home with them. Do you want to add something?
Yeah. So I had the pleasure of interviewing some elderly residents of Chinatown for a PCDC film project. And in speaking to a lot of them who are well into their 70s and 80s and asking them, you know, some of their memories of Chinatown back when, I guess they probably arrived somewhere maybe in the 50s or so. You know, so there was kind of this pattern where the men would say, there was nothing to do in Chinatown back then. And I thought to myself, really, nothing? And one of them, and so I kind of asked a little bit more, and one of them, I asked him, you know, what do you mean by nothing? And he said, there were no good dim sum palaces. And I thought to myself, I don't know, I was kind of ready to have all of this, like, you know, years and decades of wisdom imparted to me. So no dim sum palaces seemed a little trivial to me. But I think when I thought about it further and, you know, asked more questions, I think what he was talking about was just that very thing, you know, kind of the loneliness that existed at that point, and not having a whole lot of places in which to build the social fabric of the community.
So when more families became part of Chinatown and after the post-war period, how did that change Chinatown, and how did that change the life of Chinatown, the institutions of Chinatown?
Well, I could...
Anyone.
I attended the Chinese Christian Church and Center that was established in 1941. So it was right around the time when there was liberalization of the immigration policies, and it allowed some of the Chinese American men to bring their wives over to the U.S. And so it was kind of established right around that time. And I think that time period really marks kind of the beginning of Chinatown being a more family-friendly community in a lot of ways. And so actually in this issue, one of the longtime reverends of our church, Reverend Ho, he talks a lot about how the work that he did through the 1950s and 1980s with helping new immigrants. And there's some papers, actually, some of his personal papers at the HSP. And this article talks about how he helped this one family. So there was one family that came, the wife and the husband, along with eight children. I can't imagine that. I have two children now, and I'm crazy. And so they came with eight children, and he organized this group of people to meet them when they disembarked and when they landed, and brought them household items, collected together some cash and groceries and things that this family would need to welcome them into the United States. So, you know, I think that story really kind of captures what was happening at that time period, and some of, I guess, also the services that were necessary in order to welcome some new immigrants.
Yeah, I feel that, as more families move to Philadelphia, I feel that the culture, the language, there was more culture, more language in Chinatown. as the years progressed, as more families moved to Philadelphia, because in the 60s and 50s, Deborah talked about isolation, right? Which is very true. But as post-World War II, 60s and 70s, as Chinatown's population grew, I think there was such a strong desire to celebrate one's culture, yet many of the bachelors were not able to do so. As the population increased, they brought with them Chinese culture and more resources and more access to China and to Hong Kong and to Taiwan, wherever the families immigrated from. So for instance, I know as a young boy, there's a grocery store that still exists in Taking. It's probably the longest operating grocery store in Chinatown today. And I would wait for Saturday mornings because at that time, in the early 70s, a lot of the dim sum you talk about had to be delivered via truck from New York's Chinatown to Philadelphia, and Taking was the one of the grocery stores that sold these food items. So, and one of my favorites was something called Bak Tong Fo, right? And they didn't make it here in Philadelphia, so Saturday mornings I would wait, but late 70s, early 80s, Philadelphia becomes a Chinatown that can produce a lot of its own food products, and along with that, the culture, more cultural celebration. Chinese New Year's was the one holiday in the history of Chinatown, I think we see black and white photos that was celebrated. But as time moves forward, you know, Lunar Festival, which is Mid-Autumn Festival, many different celebrations. Today, throughout the year, Chinatown has many celebrations. And I think that's sort of opposite of what happens with the other immigrant groups. You know, as you have first, second, third generation, you sort of lose that culture. But I find that in Chinatown, it's actually grown.
I also think that geopolitics played a big role in this. It was McCarthy era in the 50s. It was Cold War. China was cut off. And in fact, it was, I remember my mother saving money to send to China to support her family, but she couldn't send it directly to China. She had to pay agents. She had to send it to Hong Kong because it was illegal to mail letters to China. It was illegal. It was actually a crime on the US government side to send money into China, that you would be, there was a documentary a few years back about folks in New York who got caught sending money to their families, and guys actually committed suicide because the US government was prosecuting them as spies. And I remember this, that loneliness still extended, at least for my family, because my mother couldn't communicate directly with her family. There was always this roundabout kind of crazy way, and everything was sort of under the table. Like, we couldn't get newspapers, you couldn't, that was before the internet, it was before videotapes even. It was very, we were cut off from anything that was Chinese at that time. You couldn't get imported foods from China, you couldn't get clothes. I mean, you could get it from Taiwan or you could get it from Hong Kong, but you couldn't get anything from China. And it was after, actually, Nixon, God rest his soul, when Nixon went to, when Nixon went to China in 72 and there was normalization, that's when I think we started to see like Chinese stuff starting to appear, and it became more okay. But before that, because I think largely because of McCarthyism, it was, my parents made a choice not to kind of like tell us not to speak Chinese, if you can believe that. They were afraid that people outside would hear us speaking Chinese. And they didn't want us, but because remember where I grew up, it wasn't here. Otherwise I'd be much more bilingual than I am.
You mentioned speaking Chinese. A lot of people spoke the village language. The biggest group is Toi San. I happen to be Hawk San, but I don't understand. I was blessed because my family, my mother never spoke English. And my mother and father spoke Cantonese and the restaurant they use Cantonese, so I could go to the store to buy stuff. But 1950s, a lot of the GIs married, and that brought families into the community. Mm. The Chinese Exclusion Act 1881, they kept all the labor class Chinese out of the country and kept their wives out of the country. Until 1964, when they changed the laws, the immigration laws under Johnson administration, then families were reunited after 40 years, 30 years of separation. Then Chinatown exploded.
It's a huge turning point, and it's interesting that just at the moment when Chinatown is really growing and thriving in terms of these new immigration coming in, that's when urban renewal hits the community and begins to affect the community. So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about the impact of urban renewal and how the community responded to that.
Yes, yeah, so I think it's important to note that Chinatown was founded in an area that was basically called Skid Row, Red Light District. It's probably a neighborhood that was very undesirable for most mainstream Americans. Yet, Chinatown, as you heard me say, is my home and a sanctuary for many people. Yet, the outside looking in, there's probably this view that this whole east side of City Hall needs redevelopment. And Chinatown, as a neighborhood, needs to be redeveloped to make way for progress, whether it's the highway or a long list of various projects. So I think that's what we had to deal with, this outside perception that Chinatown is not a desirable place and we need to make it better, because by making this area better, we redeveloped the entire east side of Philadelphia. Yet the outsiders didn't realize that there's these people that live in this area that we call home.
John, you have to mention that in Hong Kong, a family of eight could live in a two-room apartment. That's all they had. So they come to Philadelphia, had four rooms, they're double the luxury. And just, it wasn't for Holy Redeemer Church and school and saving that. And here's a Baptist saving a Catholic church. It wasn't, I look deeper because my sister Cecilia Moy, one thing we need in Chinatown is housing. Once we conquered Holy Redeemer Stable, then they had Dynasty Court on Ray Street, they had Onlook House, they had the new home. They were the first home since 1847, vintage. Those townhouses are on Spring Street and Winter Street. This is the thing. You have to look beyond the traditional Chinese of today to today. If you want to talk about going to heaven, oh, that's when I'm ready to die, not when I'm still young.
I also think at that time, with urban renewal, we call, you know, like around the country it was happening. It was a national phenomenon that lots of local communities were being removed, and they actually referred to it as urban removal. And it was low-income communities. It was largely communities of color. It was largely highways. We were talking about this before. To make it more convenient for people who had moved to the suburbs to come into the city for entertainment or work and then get out. And one of the things that's striking about the struggle, the continual struggle to save this community, there's not many communities left in general, but in Philadelphia in particular, in this downtown corridor, there's condo buildings where people live next door to each other and don't know each other. There's no memory, there's no historical memory. You don't mark special events in your life. I mean, I was married in Chinatown. You know, we had celebrations every time my kids were born in Chinatown. And, you know, so like you walk around and you say, oh, that's where I did this, that's where I did. That's what a community is. That's what a neighborhood is. And most people in this city don't have the beauty of that anymore. And so fighting to keep Chinatown, I don't know, that this whole urban renewal thing was like a destruction of memory and of relationships and things that, that tie you to place.
Yeah, and at that time, at the time when they were planning for these mega projects around Chinatown, they were demolishing, taking houses through eminent domain, demolishing them and leaving these vacant lots full of rubble. And Chinatown lost 25% of its housing during that period. So that's a significant amount of housing that then was gone. And in many ways that, that structured the priorities that, that then followed when the Save Chinatown movement evolved into an urban community development program.
Yeah, I think that's not all.
See, the history, you have to understand something. Before the 1960s, if you were Chinese, you had to live in Chinatown, unless you owned a laundry outside of Chinatown or a restaurant. If you were Polish, you, they only sold in Polish neighborhoods to you. If you were Italian, that's why South Philly is Italian. That's why, if you were Irish, that's why Fishtown is Irish. We were all present. Each group had their Germantown. Army was all German. You could hear them speaking German. 1960, they had, you know, the breakdown, the immigration, the prejudice and all this. Open housing. As soon as a certain race moves in, everybody moves out. And now you've got a, now you've got a hodgepodge of everything. And to try to retain an ethnicity in the community, isn't. They've done a research in Chicago where they expanded the University of Chicago. They had a Jewish neighborhood, they had a Ukrainian neighborhood, and they had an Italian neighborhood. And they said, with all that urban renewal, destroy it. Now, I'll tell you one thing. Logan was a Jewish neighborhood when my parents first rented a house in 1939. This German neighbor went around with a petition to keep us out because we are Chinese, and the Jewish neighbor said no. They had a Jewish lawyer, and when they built Logan in 1910, it was printed on the deed, no Jews, no Catholics, only Protestants.
We want to continue with the panel discussion, and there'll be time after we're done for comment and questions, so I encourage you to save your remarks for that time. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think this is more for people in Chinatown and for people that appreciate Chinatown. This was more about, it's more than just about redevelopment of a neighborhood, right? I think from the Chinese perspective, an American in Philadelphia, you know, we found a place where we could call home. You know, we didn't belong here, we didn't belong there, we didn't belong here. But we found a place that we called Chinatown that we called our home. So, and this was in 1870 when we figured we first established Chinatown. So 90 years later, right, the government comes by and says, well, this may be Chinatown, but we need to make way for the highway and for all this urban renewal for the benefit of the city of Philadelphia. So not only are they telling us that, well, maybe you found a home, but it's too bad. What's more important is that we have big plans for the city of Philadelphia, and unfortunately you're in the way of the, these plans. So I think from the community perspective, from my perspective, you know, that's inside looking out.
So how did the response to the expressway and the formation of PCBC and other organizations in the community, kind of, how did that then evolve into a redevelopment strategy, and how did that then subsequently shape the neighborhood?
I think there was a realization that the people of Chinatown could no longer sit still and let City Hall and Harrisburg dictate what would happen to this community. There was a realization that we needed to act on our behalf and be proactive. So the essence of any community are the residents, the people that live there. It's also the fact that every community that you look in, look towards has a school. Every community has a church. So in order for Chinatown to remain a community and to make sure we have roots, deep, deep roots in this community, we had to make sure we had all three components. So this began PCDC's work in trying to build new housing, to set, bring in more families, and to establish our roots as a Chinatown. Because we realize that without the housing, there's no residents, and without residents, the politics of it is that means there's no voters. Okay. I think through the history of the beginning of the Vine Street Expressway and urban renewal, the advocates of this community realized that we need political power, and the way we get political power is by increasing the voter base. So we went through this whole plan of establishing housing for Chinatown, for the people of Chinatown.
And I think oftentimes when we think about redevelopment, we do think simply in terms of what physical buildings have been constructed, but I think there's been the work of other organizations also, like Asian Americans United, that have, that they've sponsored and created the Mid-Autumn Festival and these different cultural events in order to really bring together a community. So I think people have already talked about how Philadelphia's Chinatown is really a cultural region. And I think it's really significant that many of the most avid activists throughout history have actually not lived in Chinatown. And that's definitely related to the dearth of housing stuff. But I think people are committed to Chinatown and feel a part of Chinatown because it's more than just about quality of life issues for residents. It's about the claiming the right to cultural citizenship and the right to maintain cultural traditions. And so I think when we talk about redevelopment, things like these cultural events and these festivals that we have now is really part of that redevelopment effort.
Do you want to talk about the Mid-Autumn Festival and how that got started?
Well, 17 years ago. Actually, it's interesting because young people today don't know what Chinatown was like without this festival. The Mid-Autumn Festival, I remember being a kid, and once a year my parents, again, they would come down here and they would bring back this pink box with these really heavy cakes that left little grease marks on the bottom of the cardboard, and like tell us to eat them, and we didn't like them, and we'd be like, why are you doing this, and making us eat these things, and then, but they would be actually kind of sad. It was clearly supposed to be a celebration. What I didn't know is that Mid-Autumn Festival is kind of like Thanksgiving. It's kind of like when your family is supposed to be together and you're supposed to eat a lot of food and celebrate the harvest moon. And my parents were here alone and feeling separated and lonely. So, and then I think to add insult to injury is their crazy American-born, American-raised kids who had no respect for that tradition, didn't even know why, would make faces, go, ew, I don't want to eat that. You know, I'm so sorry, Mom. And it wasn't until actually when I finished college, I decided to go to Hong Kong because I knew I wanted to come back here and I knew I wanted to work in Chinatown and I knew my Cantonese stunk. So I lived in Hong Kong for 2 years and I met my husband, and the first Mid-Autumn Festival was actually our very first date. So it means a lot. Yeah, see, I'm like, yeah, now that the full moon. Very romantic. But I saw what this festival meant for the first time in my life. I saw how carefully his mother prepared the food. I saw the kids all piling around the table, eating and getting fresh flowers and pulling out lanterns and going out and celebrating the moon. And I thought, oh my God, this is what it's supposed to be. And I felt such a sense of loss, such a sense of, I'm 22, and for the first time in my life, I understand this thing that meant so much to my parents. Anyways, we came back to Philly, and I started working, and I worked a lot with immigrant youth. And 17 years ago, there was a group of young Chinese immigrant youth that my husband and I used to take out all the time because their parents were like just too busy. And it was August, I still remember this. We took them for a picnic down on East River Drive, and they started talking about Mid-Autumn Festival coming up. And they started talking about how much they missed it, how much they missed home. And then one kid in particular, Andy, said, I know my grandparents raised me, because his parents came over here to work and then eventually sent for him. He said, I miss my grandparents so much, and that night in the village, I know they're going to come out. I'm such a crybaby. They're going to come out, and they're going to look at the same moon that I'll look at, and then I'll know at least we'll be together. And I just was like, oh my God. And then they were talking some more, and they talked about the old people in Chinatown and how lonely they must be and how much they must miss this festival. And they talked about the kids that were like the Juksin, the empty bamboo that had no idea what this stuff was. And so my husband and I looked at them and said, well, we could make a festival. And they said, we could? And we said, yeah, we'll help you make a festival. I had no idea what we were getting into, but the kids all wanted to do this for the elderly. So they went to Unlock House and put up some flyers, and we put these flyers all around Chinatown. We talked to Father Tom at Holy Redeemer. We said, can we use the parking lot here? We want to do this little festival. And we put up these things, just come out, have a picnic, and then we put on these really cheesy shows. And we thought, 20 people, 30 people, 400 people showed up. 400 people, we thought, oh my God, like, we're not the only people that miss this. We're not the only people that have lost this. And so then we felt, then we were like, oh my God, now we have to do this every year. but AAU has continued, and this year was the 17th year of the Mid-Autumn Festival, and it runs with, there's probably 6,000 to 10,000 people that come down throughout the day. There's 150 students from around Philadelphia that volunteer. They come down for the day, they volunteer, because the festival, we have no money, so it's all done by volunteers. And then I always do the orientation for the kids. And there was one year, maybe 4 years ago, and I always started with the same question, can you guys remember when there was no Mid-Autumn Festival in Chinatown? And about 4 or 5 years ago, not a single kid raised their hand. And then that's when I thought, oh my God, like, we've created a tradition, a memory for children, like the kids now growing up down here in Philly, can't remember a time that there was no festival. But there's a little danger in that, because they kind of take it for granted. They don't realize that these things that are so precious, we actually had to fight for. We actually had to fight to recreate.
Well, we're almost out of time for the panel, which this time went by so quickly, but I want to make sure that we have time for comments and questions from the audience. But in the time that we have remaining, I guess I want to end with one question. What Debbie and I were talking about over email, the so what question. Why is it important? I mean, Chinatown has struggled to survive over the last century and plus. Why is it important that Chinatown survive? Why do we need Chinatown? Why is it important to preserve and grow this community in this place?
I think that, so we've been talking about the history of Chinatown and how it began really as a place to shield people from segregation. And I think, in a lot of ways, it's still that kind of a place, and I know there's a lot of talk about the U.S. being a post-racial society, but discrimination still exists and prejudice still exists, and so I think that when that still exists, and until that's still, until that's extinct, there is really an important place for Chinatown. And I think, for me personally, so I've only been in Philadelphia for 7 years, but since I came to Philadelphia, I've been attending the Chinese Christian Church and Center, and a lot of families in our church actually live out in the suburbs, but they bring their kids to a Chinese church and to a church in Chinatown, because culture and having their kids maintain cultural traditions is really important to them, where, they don't feel like the minority in their school. And I think, for me, especially after having two children, it's really a place, I mean, it sounds kind of cheesy, but it really is a place where people know you. We walk down the streets, and I know this, For better or for worse, yes, true. Where, you know, you walk down the street and people care about you. And I think, especially for me, for our family, my parents live in New York and my husband's family, they live in California. And so my children don't have their grandparents here. And being part of a multi-generational church that's in Chinatown, they get to kind of experience that and have surrogate grandparents who care for them. So that's on a personal note. Mm-hmm.
My response to that is...
No, you're not getting off that easy.
It's right here.
Read your really short excerpt. A walk down the streets of Chinatown tickles my senses. Whiffs of Cantonese, Hunan, and Sichuan cooking emanate from the rows of restaurants. I see grandmothers harvesting the vegetables for the evening's dinner from their tiny backyard gardens. Only a few lucky ones have backyards in Chinatown. I spot roast ducks hanging behind the glass windows of delicatessens, and I crave for the roast duck and wonton rice noodle soup that I love. I know the scalding hot soup will burn my tongue, yet I can taste the flavor of the broth that separates the phenomenal from the decent restaurants. So Chinatown is a sense of place and belonging for me, and I think for many people. I don't think you have to live in this community to feel that way. I think I've said this many times, and Chinatown is a hub for many Asian Americans in the greater Philadelphia area. And so what, why is Chinatown important? Chinatowns are important and have a place throughout the cities that they're located throughout the United States. And, you know, it's part of history. So we have the Liberty Bell, we have Valley Forge, so much history in the city of Philadelphia. Yet I would say that Chinatown is the only place where you can see history and you can see change, yet it's living and breathing. It's a living museum that you can come to and just experience culture, learn about the history, and see just how it's evolving. And in some ways, I can almost see the future of Chinatown. Of all the advocates here at this table and many more that are not here, I see all their passion about Chinatown. I can almost see what Chinatown's gonna be like 10, 20 years down the road. It's gonna continue to be a hub for Asian Americans. It's gonna continue to have this sense of place and belonging for many, many people. So that's why, so what?
And for me, I guess, like, talk story again. I have four kids. My second son, Aaron, when he was 5, I tell this story often. If you've heard it, just turn off your hearing. When he was 5, he came home from school and he said to me, "I don't want to be Chinese anymore." And my snarky side was like, too late, but I kind of sat down with him and I said, "Well, why are you saying that?" And he said, "Because Chinese people are stupid." And I said, like, "Am I stupid?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Is your daddy stupid?" He said, "No." "Is your uncle stupid? Is your auntie stupid? Is your grandfather stupid?" Said, "No, no, 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 no." I said, "So why don't you want to be Chinese?" "Because Chinese people are stupid." And I said, "Well, why are you saying that?" And he said, "Because in my school, everyone calls me stupid Chinese boy." And so I realized that in spite of our best intent, I was fighting for his identity. I was fighting for him to not be ashamed of who he was. And so when he was 5, I grabbed his Ninja Turtles and I said, "Look, what does this say? It says made in China. You know, if they were stupid, they wouldn't be able to make one of them." And so, you know, that helped him when he was 5, but it wasn't going to help him as he got older. What eventually happened, I was walking through Chinatown, and people find this hard to believe, but when I was younger, I actually studied Kung Fu, and I saw Shifu, and my son was about 8 at that time. And I introduced them, and I said, "Aaron, you wanna learn Kung Fu?" And his eyes got like huge. And he said, "Could I really learn that?" And I said, "Sure, you know, I'll bring you down, you could learn." And it's like, he was so excited because he's finally like someplace where everyone's listening to the Chinese guy. So you know, I used to give them a little spending money, and we live right near a Super Fresh, if you know where 10th and Bainbridge is. We live right, you always can get stuff on sale, and I used to give him a little money, and he loved to get candy. And he would always wait until he came down to Chinatown for Kung Fu class to go to this one little store where there was a laundromat and there was a right on 10th Street to get his candy. But I knew that the candy cost more at that store. So I sat him down and I said, you know, how come you always get your candy here? And he said, because the guy knows my Chinese name. And no one knows my Chinese name. And when I go to the store, he always says hello to me. And he uses my Chinese name. And so here he was, this little kid, who realized that, like, it's not about how cheap you can get it. It's not about the deals we can make, the Walmarting of the world, the material things that make us happy. It's the, like, he's teaching me this lesson. This little 8-year-old is teaching me a lesson that in a community where people know your name, like, it's worth fighting for. It's worth spending the extra 25 cents. It's worth, because he knows that it's going to support this guy who knows his name. And when you say, so what for Chinatown, like Chinatown is what America should be. It's what's being lost, and not just in America. It's being lost around the world. And people, it's not just history, it's not just know that community is what makes us human. So it's not just Chinatown that we have to fight for, but you know, for us, it's Chinatown. But for everyone in this room, I think it's gotta be for those fundamental places and spaces where you can understand like the value of relationships and community.
That's a nice note to end on. I'd like to open it up. Well, we're a little over time, but we started late, so I'm still going to give us 10 minutes for audience. So if anybody has any questions or comments, feel free to ask.
Mm-hmm. Can I use the podium?
Sure, why not?
Good evening. I'm Ignatius Wong. Actually, I'm here. I'm quite different from the panel. I'm an immigrant. I didn't grow up in Chinatown. I was born in China, and I spent my childhood in Beijing. Grew up and educated in Taiwan. 1966, I came to the United States. And in 1968, I came to Philadelphia. I'm an architect. First day I report to work, my fellow architect, Eric Chong, remember the name, took me to Chinatown and introduced me to the real Chinese in Chinatown. And I've been a volunteer in Chinatown ever since. When I first came to Chinatown, we couldn't buy fresh milk in Chinatown grocery store. And if you didn't speak Cantonese, you're not a real Chinese. The comment is that, what kind of Chinese are you? You don't speak Chinese. Things have changed. Things have changed. I'm glad that Debbie mentioned President Nixon. President Nixon went to China in 1972. Not only he opened up the relationship between between China and America, he also sent fear to people in Hong Kong and Taiwan. The balance of power across the Taiwan Strait was changing because of the international event. Nixon opened up China. So people in Taiwan started trying to move out. You're nodding, you understand that. So that we see the money and people from Taiwan came to the United States. They went to Los Angeles, they went to Houston, they went to San Francisco, they changed Monterey Park, California into a Chinatown overnight.
So, do you have a question?
Yeah, I don't have a question. I want to give everybody a different perspective. When Hong Kong was scheduled to go back to China, money and people started leaving Hong Kong. Money and people went to the former British Empire. They went to Canada, they went to Australia, they went to even New Zealand. And we see some of the money went to New York City, and Philadelphia Chinatown lacking the venue for investment. We also start seeing people with a Hong Kong connection.
I'm going to make sure that we have.
I'm going to tell you why Chinatown matters. Vietnam, the Americans evacuated Vietnam. Boat people started coming to North America. Some of them are ethnic Chinese. Chinatown was overcrowded, and they started a new Chinatown around Washington Avenue. And in the last 10 years, and of course, China has opened up their policy, so the both America and China have relaxed the immigration process, and we started seeing more Chinese coming directly from China. And I see some of the preservation student back there. From,
I want to make sure that we have time for other people's questions.
Okay. And basically, what I'm saying is that our local activists kept the door open for the fall and the rise of Chinatowns all across North America has to do with international events and our foreign policy. That is why Chinatown matters.
Okay, great. we really are out of time, but are there any other questions?
I got one, I promise it's a question. I'm a local tour guide. I'm part of the Tour Guide Association, and I often take guests through Chinatown. We actually have a specific Chinatown tour. My company is in multiple cities, one of which is New York. So I get a large amount of New Yorkers, people from DC and Chicago coming to Philadelphia. And one of the number one comments that they have about Philadelphia's Chinatown versus those other big cities, which, I mean, New York's Chinatown is what, the first or second, it's the fluctuating size of San Francisco's, how we are not as affected by gentrification. And they use that word almost as if it's a negative and loss of culture. And it's almost something that they look at me and say, you know, hang on to it. It's almost, have you guys thought of addressing that? Because a lot of new businesses are you know, how do you view this? You know, because they looked at it as kind of like, be afraid of it. And that's how, I'm just transferring it to you guys. I'd like to see how you as community leaders view it and things of that nature.
From the community development side of the world, gentrification is a huge concern. For especially low-income neighborhoods, right? So for Chinatowns, we have extreme high poverty. City of Philadelphia's poverty rate is about 25%, or 43% in Chinatown. We want to be able to make sure that the people that can least afford to live in Chinatown can live in Chinatown. So we have high demand for affordable housing. That's number one. At the same time, we must recognize as a community that having a community of all low-income people, the economy cannot survive. So what's really important for Chinatown or any communities is that well thought out planned neighborhoods that have mixed income families. The most important caveat is that those that can least afford to live in the community should be provided the opportunity to do so if they choose to do so.
Yeah, and I think the whole history of Chinatown has been just like one big struggle to stop projects from taking over this community. So whether or not it was Vine Street, whether or not it was a federal prison, whether or not it was, you know, sometimes you lose, you get the gallery, you get bus depots that dump their pollution, but, and then you get the baseball stadiums, you get the casinos. You're sitting, this building that you're sitting in was supposed to be a parking lot for the baseball stadium. The city said to us, that's just empty land up there, you're not gonna do anything with it, we have to gentrify your neighborhood, we have to make it better. So once the stadium was gone, the owner of this building actually got a lot of offers to turn it into condos, to turn it into hotels, and we approached them about putting a school in this building, and we said, okay, so we don't know if we have a charter, we don't know if the school's gonna open, we don't know, if we know that it's gonna cost you maybe $4 million to fix the building, we don't have any money, we don't, because we don't have a charter, we can't take a loan out to fix the building. Will you fix it for us and rent it to us? And actually, Mr. Wong looked us right in the eye and he said, are you serious about opening a school in this community? And we said, yes. And he said, we have lots of condos that are displacing our people. We have lots of hotel rooms where our people can't be. We need a school. I will take the loan out. I will gamble. I will invest in this building and I'll rent it to you. So going back to that, so what? That's what a community is. So yeah, people have, all communities I think that have been around look at gentrification with real trepidation.
Because it's like, almost something of what attracted them to come here, because that we have not been so effective. We've almost stepped it off. That's why they've come, to see almost what they lost.
Yeah, and exactly.
And they look at me like, wow, how'd you guys do it? So that's why I was asking to see what was the
not easy. When they try to build that casino again, and I'm sure they will, you know, come on out and help.
Well, I think the thing about gentrification, too, is this: you can protest a stadium, you can protest a casino, you can
but
protest
you can't, a right.
How do you protest gentrification?
Yeah, it's insidious.
It's just there. Yeah. Okay, we have to stop. I'm sorry, but I encourage you to continue the conversation while we dine on this lovely food at a reception. And thank you all so much. Thank you to the panelists.
Work on a project. If you want more information about the history and places in Chinatown, chinatownplaces.tumblr.com. I have some cards up there.
Thank you all, and please enjoy.